Goddess of Yesterday, A Tale of Troy. Chapter 8. The first, fourth, and seventh days of every month are holy, but fifth days are harsh and angry. On the fifth day of the last month of summer, the Trojans arrived. Prince Paris, killer of that innocent little boy, his cousin Aeneas, and a dozen companions apiece. The three older royal children were permitted to come to the formal welcome. Hermione led in by her nurse, the boys by their squires. I knew I should obey Ethra and stay away, but I couldn't bear to miss anything. Never before had a Trojan been under the roof of Amyclae. Trojans are armed to the teeth, sword in hand, spear hanging from the shoulder, dagger clenched in the jaws. But guests disarm in the forecourt, their weapons stored by the host. It's exciting, isn't it? Hermione whispered. I wish we could see Paris and Aeneas with knives in their teeth. Paris was as beautiful a man as Helen was a woman. Bare from the waist up, Paris wore a panther skin over his shoulders. His muscles glistened and slid over strong bones. His body was perfect, without a single scar. His hair the same honey and spice as Helen's. Every curl tight, as if just wound around some woman's fingers. His lips were as rosy as a child's, full of movement, as if every time he saw a man, he thought of speaking, and every time he saw a woman, he thought of love. The court furniture that had been brought out in honor of Agamemnon was brought out for Paris of Troy. Paris and Aeneas were seated on ebony chairs inlaid with gold palm trees, which Menelaus had found in Egypt. Menelaus sat on his throne, and Helen beside him on her chair. The companions gazed open-mouthed at Helen, like young boys. Menelaus might sit on the throne, but when Helen chose to glitter, he was in shadow. Her tiara that evening was wisps of gold, flying gold wasps among golden hammered flowers. I thought it perfect for Helen, spun with a sting. King and prince exchanged greetings. Ingots of bronze and tin, bales of brocaded cloth, and boxes of gems and ivory. Each side praised the other, and honor was paid to the gods. Then Paris stepped back from Menelaus and turned toward the queen. I never saw a person who didn't want to touch Helen. Strangers yearned to drape her cloak. Servants ached for the privilege of combing her hair or washing her feet. All who lived in this kingdom wanted Helen's praise. And now, a Trojan. Yet the Prince of Troy did not speak. The room seemed oddly still and very hot, as the sky heats before thunder. When Paris knelt, he sank so slowly, I didn't see how he could keep his balance. And when he clasped her knees, as men do when pleading for mercy, she looked at his hands as if they were the hands of Zeus. I heard you were a white swan, my queen, said Paris. A crown of glory, a star fallen from heaven. I was told that in your presence I would stumble. Those who have had the privilege of resting their eyes upon you discover that they never again are able to rest, for their trembling hearts forever think of none but you. Oh, Helen, Aphrodite, blessed goddess of love, has led me to your feet. Bree's a woman who wouldn't like to hear such things. Bree's a woman who would not enjoy having the goddess of love invoked at the sight of her, but Bree's there a husband who would permit it. Menelaus, however, had heard this kind of thing from dozens of princes when they were all begging Helen to marry one of them. He seemed bored by Paris's speech. Aeneas, the cousin, broke the spell. He was not handsome like Paris, but he was more important. For Aeneas, like Helen, was half god. His mother had been the same Aphrodite, goddess of love. We did not worship Aphrodite on Cephnus, so I didn't know her. I had heard that she was as cruel as Apollo, and that frightened me, for how could love be cruel? Actually, my lord Menelaus, said Aeneas, Aphrodite did escort us. She is the figurehead on Paris's ship. The goddess went first through the waves, bringing us a speedy and blessed arrival. I didn't think that was respectful. A goddess forced to break the waves day after day, splashed in salt spray and plastered with seaweed? A figurehead should be a fish, not an immortal. Hermione whispered to me, Aeneas doesn't talk as if Aphrodite really is his mother, does he? Many claim to be the children of gods. In this room, both Aeneas and Helen. Is it true? Is any man or woman actually son or daughter of a god? Paris stood reluctantly, as one who would have liked to spend his life looking up at Helen. O Queen, you are not simply a swan, and you are far greater than a dove. I see in you also the eagle. Helen's eyes were very bright. I do not have wings, Paris of Troy. Yet you fly into the heart of every man who sees you. She had to smile then. I had not previously seen her true smile. It lit the room. It warmed every heart. It stayed so short a time on her lovely face that every one of us in the Megaron yearned to do or say something to make that smile return. Paris snapped his fingers. Forward came servants struggling under the weight of two extraordinary gifts for Helen, larger-than-life hounds of polished red marble with collars of gold and obsidian eyes that glittered black in the smoke. May they guard your doors, O Queen, said Paris. The husband responsible for guarding Helen's doors sat right there, but Menelaus seemed not to be insulted. He just laughed. It's more appropriate that you know, Paris. Helen doesn't care for real dogs. They shed fur and nip ankles. Our son's puppies have to be kept at some distance from my wife's room. Paris had brows like shelves above his deep, dark eyes, and he raised them high and regarded Menelaus with amusement. The king of Amyclae had just admitted publicly that he and his lovely queen did not share a room. How wise of you, Helen, said Paris. A queen must have perfection. Thus, I bring you perfect pets of stone. And what form of perfection must you have, my prince, said Helen? A good, fertile farm? A gentle life at home? A host of fair children? Paris shouted with laughter. Those are not to my taste, my queen. I revel in long ships with oars. I love the heft of a polished lance and the slice of arrows in the skirmish. His body, however, was notably free of blemishes. A warrior's flesh tells a tale, for it is scarred and pitted from attack and defense. Even a youth learning to use his father's weapons ends up scabbed for life. But Paris was as smooth and beautiful as a newborn babe. What a king you will be one day, Paris, said Helen, although the whole room knew that 49 brothers stood between Paris and the throne of Troy. A king should stain the world with blood. A king should live for his spear. Some warriors, she said, go soft the moment they return home. I and all the court knew that Helen was accusing Menelaus of such softness. I prayed Paris would not understand. I prayed Menelaus would not. Such a man, said the Prince of Troy, his eyes as fastened to Helen's as the suction cups of an octopus had once been fastened to my arm, cannot be called a warrior. Squires entered bearing clubs of wine, while Paris and Helen stared at each other. When everyone had a cup, the squires poured each man a few drops, and Paris and Helen still stared at each other. Menelaus stood to lead the guests as they tipped out wine for the deathless gods. Then each cup filled, and then each man drank. Paris lifted his cup to Helen. Helen lifted her cup to him. Men have all the adventures, whispered Hermione. But now at least we will hear about them, and from the lips of a Trojan warrior. The first story Paris told was how he himself had caught the panther, whose skin now covered his back. It had been a huge beast, and the room shuddered to think of the combat with such a creature. But his cousin Aeneas studied the fire on the hearth during the story, pushing ashes around with the tip of his boot, drawing circles of soot. Aeneas does not believe it, I thought. Possibly Aeneas is the one who really slew the panther. When the story had ended, and Helen was stroking the fine, soft panther hide, her long white arm brushed the bare, gleaming chest of Paris. Aeneas turned to the royal children. "You must be Hermione, for you look like a child goddess, dusted in gold. And these two fine young men must be Ethiolus and Merophaeus. Lord Menelaus, how envious I am of such sons. And who is this little princess?" Paris turned his back on Helen to see what princess Aeneas meant. "Me." Helen turned to Ice. The princess, who was no princess, has drawn Paris's gaze away from her. I felt the obsidian eyes of her two hounds. They would rise up and bite me if Helen had such a command in her power. "I am Callisto, sir, from Cephnus," I said to Aeneas. Paris laughed. "So you are the daughter of the king with the gold mine, who broke his word to the gods. Your background is lead, not gold." He turned again to Helen. "I burned to defend Nicator." But he had no defense. "In more than one way she is lead, not gold," Helen told Paris. "I believe the girl is an impostor. I believe she comes from some other isle altogether." "Fascinating," said the prince. And a second time he turned his back on Helen to examine me. "Now, Helen," said Menelaus, "Nicander, along with all his people, was slain by pirates," he told the Trojans. "Only this brave and sturdy daughter survived. I have taken her into my household, of course. When an island or a prince or princess is born, Zeus shakes his two jars and pours out the future. Both a person and an island will have some good fortune and some dread." The court prepared to be bored by lengthy stories they had all heard too many times. "Poor Nicander," said Menelaus, "drank deeply from the cup of sorrow." "I, however," said Paris, "drink only from the cup of joy. For I look upon this face, this queen, this Helen." Taking Helen's gold cup from her hands, stroking her long, slim fingers very slowly, he brought the queen's cup to his own face and ran his lips around the rim where hers had touched. Something came over Helen and shook her like wind falling on mountain oaks. Her ivory cheeks pinked and her hand trembled. Aeneas joined his prince, nervously, I thought. Certainly the rest of the court was a bit nervous. "What evidence have you, Helen," asked Aeneas, "that this little princess is not, in fact, from Cephnus?" "Who cares what island some urchin comes from," said Paris. "One rock in the sea looks like another." "Let us discuss something worthy of you, O queen. You will visit Troy one day, I promise you, Helen of the sun and the moon and the stars. We are glory and gold. We are wide skies and a great plain, brilliant warriors and splendid horses." "Strong princes," said Helen, "and swift ships." I drifted out of the Megaron, keeping the wide shoulders of Trojans and Spartans between me and Helen. I need not have troubled. Helen never took her eyes from Paris. Tiptoeing down the wide, dark hall, I climbed up the long stair that clung to the whitewashed walls, around the landing, up the next stair, and from there to the fretwork of the balcony. It was packed with women who made room for me. Menelaus was eager to learn of every city and shore, every adventure and storm at sea. The companions of Paris obliged. The wine was passed continually, for nothing pleases men more than another sip. Paris laughed steadily. There was something discomforting about a man so easily amused, especially one whose reason for coming was that he had murdered a little boy. Merophaeus fell asleep, sagging in his father's arms. Ichthyolus drooped. Baia had long since escorted Hermione out of the room. "I have a request," said Paris languidly. "From my father, Priam, the great king of Troy." Aeneas studied his cup. He had drunk very little, and Paris had drunk a great deal. Aeneas did not seem happy with this new subject. "Perhaps, my dear King Menelaus," said Paris, "you recall that my father Priam had a sister, Hesione by name. Many years ago, Hesione was kidnapped by one of your kings, Telamon by name. He made our beloved Troy princess his slave." I was not prepared for his anger, and I don't think Paris was either. When Menelaus stiffened, you could see the great breadth of his barrel chest and the width of his shoulders. The fury in the huge hands that now gripped his own knees, as if he were preventing himself from knocking the visitor down. When you refer to Hesion, young man, do not make up your own version. The great Hercules, the hero and warrior of Greece, went to Troy. Hercules found your gates open and your people slack. He attacked Troy and won handily, am I correct? I had never known that. I had never heard anybody refer to any defeat of Troy, let alone within living memory. We in the balcony held our breath. The Trojan companions, who had been tired and a little drunk, were now flushed and humiliated. Their muscles shifted as they considered reaching and gripping weapons. But they had none. Not even studded leather to bind their knuckles, a weapon that permits one strike of the fist to kill. Aeneas, graceful and calm, said quietly, "It happened as you say, Lord." Menelaus did not stand. It was his throne room. He had power just sitting there. But at a glance from him, his men too shifted position. Their spears were not leaning against a distant wall. They had not had too much to drink. When Hercules had beaten Troy, said Menelaus, relishing the words, the great hero took his due. His soldier Telamon, having slaughtered many, was awarded the Princess Hesione as his prize. All this was just and proper. The stories of Hesione were many. She had been raped by Hercules, or saved from sea monsters by Hercules. She was now a pitiful drudge slaving in the house of Telamon, or she was Telamon's honored wife. Every year she bribed traders to take her home to Troy. Or every year she laughed in their faces and spit on Troy. Wise King Priam knows all this, said Menelaus, for he and I discussed it at length during my recent visit. Telamon married Hesione. Hesione is his queen, not his servant. There was no need for any man to wed his captive. Telamon must have loved her to do that. Hesione is not only Telamon's queen in Salamis, said Menelaus, and no man in the court was bored by the story he told now. She is also the mother of his beloved son, Tosser. Your cousin, Paris. Your age, in fact. But unlike you, Tosser will become a king. The son of Hesion has a future. You, on the contrary, are the youngest son. You will do nothing in your life except obey your brothers. In the balcony, we cringed. What a slap in the guest's face, to remind him how lowly his position really was, but Paris just smiled. We acknowledge, said Aeneas carefully, that there is much truth in what you say, Lord Menelaus. But our King Priam nevertheless yearns for his sister. We will of course report to him how happy she is as Queen of Salamis, and how proud of her son Tosser. Paris found this amusing, as he had found the entire evening. My father's request having been made and refused, he said, I am free of obligation. And then he shouted, as if he and not Menelaus were the host, let us have dancing now, and song, for these are the crown of a feast. And Paris it was who led the dancing with Helen, who watched with a feverish flush. The next day, Menelaus took Paris and Aeneas on a boar hunt. Aethiolus and Merophaeus got to go along. Hermione and I spun. Helen spent the day on her balcony. Isn't that odd, said Hermione. Usually mother detests sun on her skin. I did not think it odd. She would see Paris return. She expected that he would get the boar. But Menelaus got the boar. The peasants had feared the boar, for a boar has no fear of man and will rip apart a shepherd or a sheep, a woman in the field or a child on the path. How they sang the hunter king's praises. Helen sang nothing. Paris smiled. The following day, Helen escorted Paris to the temple of Apollo in preparation for the ceremonies in which the prince would shed his blood debt. In the Megaron, Menelaus listened to petitions. Merophaeus and Aethiolus memorized history with their tutors. Plaius napped. Hermione spun. I made my way to the keeping track room. I hoped the scribes would let me try. If I could whirl a slingshot, Surely I could wield a marker thorn. I'd been working on my thoughts, and they were less smoky. I kept thinking of that Trojan princess, Hesione, who must be quite old now, as old as Ethra. At this moment, Hesione sat in a palace in Salamis, on the western rim of the Aegean Sea, while Priam, her brother, sat in the palace of Troy, on the eastern rim. Could there be a keeping track line which spoke not of objects on shelves, but of thoughts in hearts? Could there be a way for people who never see each other again to talk to each other? Yet if there was such a thing, what good would it do? If I could keep track with that marking thorn, that I hoped my parents still loved me, all I would have was a dried square of clay telling me it wouldn't tell them. And yet, clomping boots down the dark hall startled me. Still thick with thought, I stepped into a side room and slipped behind the door curtains. The steps were loud and many, but there were only two speakers, and I recognized their voices. "Lord King," said the Captain Kennedus intensely, "Paris and Aeneas have warriors on their ships." "Now, Kennedus, I would hardly expect a prince to travel unescorted," said Menelaus, with ferocity, as if Kennedus would gladly shove the king against the wall to make him listen. The captain said, "Menelaus, these are not escorts. These are troops. We need to know what Paris is really planning. He doesn't care about blood debt." "Now, Kennedus, Paris is my guest. He has gone hunting with me, bounced my little son on his lap, and played with my hounds." "Paris just wants to get to know his enemy before he attacks," said Kennedus. "Lord, at table you came close to mortal insult." "And yet he laughed, didn't he?" said Menelaus patiently. "Is that the mark of a dangerous man? Didn't you hear him tell the queen what a fine warrior he is? That he lives for the joy of throwing a lance?" "He's no warrior, Kennedus. We all bathe together after the hunt. You and I have seen every inch of his body. If Paris loves battle, he loves it from a distance. No spear tip, no arrow, not even a fist has ever touched that skin. Paris just wants a good hunt, followed by a good party." "Amyclae is what he wants," snapped Kennedus. "And after that, Sparta. And then all your kingdom. And when he has gotten us, he goes to Salamis and gets his aunt Hesione. Send a messenger to Salamis, then. Let King Telamon know that an overgrown playboy named Paris frightens you, but bother me no more." Menelaus walked away. His soldiers were so angry, they could not at first follow him. "The king is a good man," said one, trying to find an excuse. "In a king," said Kennedus grimly, "that is a flaw. I didn't go to the keeping track room after all. I had so many thoughts in my head, I couldn't keep track of anything." "I don't trust Paris," said Hermione. The hour was very late. Most of the palace was asleep. Hermione's nurse Bea and the maids were snoring on the porch. Hermione and I were sitting on her bed whispering. I had first pulled back the window curtains and then opened the hall door in hopes of a good draft. None came. "Why not?" I asked. "Father taunted Paris," she said. "I think that was a mistake. I think Paris has a plan, and Father does not." I was impressed. Hermione thought like a seasoned captain. I, however, agreed with Menelaus, not Kennedus. Paris was just watching himself shine. He had no plans. He had only parties and laughter. "If I were a general or an admiral," said Hermione, "Father would listen to me. But when I told him that Paris is a danger to the kingdom, Father just patted my head." I loved Menelaus. His captain criticized, his wife scolded, and now his daughter was correcting him. I changed the subject. "Did you see the tusks from that wild boar?" I said. "Athiolus and Merophaeus were bragging about the old boar. I don't think Father really let them anywhere near it. I bet Paris didn't get near it either. Everyone is joking about his smooth skin." "How old do you think Paris is?" 25, she guessed. How old is your mother? 28. Last year was a very sacred year for her, because 27 is 9 threes. She was sure something important would happen, but it didn't. I thought of that 9th day, when I returned to the sacred olive tree. It was only weeks ago, yet Sifnos seemed as distant as the mountains from the sea. Hermione and I leaned close, and the night wore on. And still we whispered. And so when all the household slept except the guards at the gate, we were awake when Paris of Troy walked barefoot down the hall, and Helen met him at her door. I was too shocked to breathe. If a queen is with a man, not her husband, it is treason. For if she should bear a child, it would not be the king's. A stranger's blood and history will step into the royal family and defile it. Hermione and I climbed off the bed and stepped out into the hall and looked down toward Helen's room. The two red marble dogs stared back, their black eyes glittering. I will kill them, said Hermione. The days passed. The number of people who knew what Hermione and I knew grew larger. The secret filled the palace like the stench of rotting meat, stinking in our hearts. But Menelaus arranged competitions for the pleasure of our guests, not knowing that one guest was enjoying a different sort of pleasure. We rooted for runners in quarter-mile and half-mile foot races. We screamed as chariots tipped over on the turn. We cheered for sweating wrestlers and long-throwing ball players. Harpists vied for a prize, and bards sang new songs. On the 8th day of Paris's visit, I woke to the soft clink of stones. From Hermione's window, I watched 2 men and a boy as they laid a new slate roof on the low garrony beyond the woman's garden. How neatly each stone slice lay, like fish scales. How well men put together a roof. How poorly they put together their lives. I was exactly what Helen accused me of, a girl of lead, not a princess of gold. What was I to do about this life I had stolen? For among such cruel gods, such stern kings, I felt a dread fate before me. That morning, a messenger brought news from Crete, largest island in the sea. It has 90 cities. I tried and failed to imagine 90 places like Gythion and Amyclae, all on one island. While visiting the king of Crete, the messenger told us, the grandfather of Menelaus had died in his sleep. Crete was holding off the funeral games until Menelaus arrived. Suddenly, Amyclae was buzzing and active, Menelaus' closest companions assembling to escort him to the funeral. Helen's much older brother, Castor and Pollux, came from Sparta. They would attend in honor of the old king. It was decided that Athaleus and Marypheus would go too. Boys always get adventures, said Hermione. Girls always stay home. You are so lucky, Callisto. You have had adventure. Priests arrived and choirs sang songs of mourning for the grandfather. Captain Kennedus put together the honor guard. The treasury was opened, and Helen and Menelaus chose the funeral offerings. Menelaus decided to bring 2 of his best smiths as his gift to the king of Crete. These men forged bronze, but one of them had worked the new metal, iron. The smiths were obedient and prepared to live forever in a strange land, but their wives were heartbroken and full of fear. Menelaus turned suddenly to the queen. Helen, you must honor my grandfather. Cut off your hair. I will place it in the fire of his bones. Helen was aghast. Cut off her beautiful hair like a common woman? How could Menelaus ask such a thing of Helen, daughter of a god? Menelaus pulled his dagger out of his sheath, flipped it in his hand, and passed it to her, handle first. For a moment, the blade lay in his palm, so sharp, so stained by blood. Into how many hearts had that been plunged? Helen wore her hair that day in an intricate pile of braids and curls. One by one, she pulled out the pins. How long and thick was her honey gold braid! She tossed her head so that the braid swung, and she caught the braid in her left hand. In her right, She held the knife as if she would rather slit her throat. Her eyes moved around the room, summoning affection. The room loved her. The room resented Menelaus for such a demand. A handmaiden held a silver salver to catch the falling braid. Helen swung the knife. From the curling tip at the bottom of the braid, she cut half an inch of hair. Half an inch is contempt. You are nothing to me. Menelaus said not a word. The high color in his face said it for him. The queen returned the knife blade first, and for a moment, the knife balanced between them, aimed at her husband's heart. Paris smiled at the ceiling. "Don't go to Crete," said Hermione suddenly, her child's voice as piercing as the flute that guides the ship. "Father, I don't think you should go. Please, stay here." He patted her head. "I'll bring you a present," he said. "Paris, my priest will proceed with the ceremony to release your blood debt. Feast and hunt until my return. The weather is perfect, and the sail to Crete should not take more than 2 or 3 days. I expect to be back in a week or two." Paris smiled at the ceiling. At dawn, the slim ships of Menelaus would sail the wine-dark sea, and still the king had no idea why Paris smiled. Hermione almost told him, but she could not do it, nor could any man or woman at Amyclae. "They loved Helen and Menelaus both. My goddess of yesterday travels with you," I said to my king, and Menelaus patted my head too. "I'll bring you another magic jar, Callisto." "It is you who need magic, my king," I thought sadly. Aeneas accompanied Menelaus all the way from Amyclae to the shore. I felt a little better. No one can ensure a safe journey better than a guest friend. Athiolus and Marypheus twittered like sparrows in their joy. I spotted Tenedus carrying the little prince's baggage, and I was glad for him. Funeral games on the great rich isle of Crete would be exciting. The soldiers and servants of Menelaus raised a cloud of dust under their sandals as they marched to Gythion. Even when we could no longer make them out, we could see their dust. Finally, they vanished into the darkness called forest. Thea the nurse told Hermione they would weave together, as it was high time the princess acquired more skill. Rodea his nurse told Pleus that he would nap. "Perhaps you and I will also nap, my swan," said Paris to Helen. I saw now what had made Helen's hands flutter in the Megaron, what had gone through that beautiful body like mountain wind, what had pierced a heart as bleached as marble. It was love. The heat of the day passed, and the sun went down. The dust turned to dark, and the moon rose, dropping silver light on the great walls. My thoughts were too sad for sleep. I climbed along a long stair to the battlements and sought answers in the first stars. Not only did the people of Sparta name their stars, they were planning keeping track lines for each star. From the parapet, I looked down upon the snarling lions over the gate. The gate was open. Menelaus had left open the gate of his marriage, too. The air stood still, thinking its own thoughts. Every distant mountain peak, every deep ravine seemed so infinite and dangerous as the gods. Far away and very low in the sky traveled an unusual row of flickering stars. Hundreds were colliding and flaring, then vanishing like wicks of oil lamps being blown out. I knew of no such stars in that sky. Time passed. No guard walked by me. No night watch closed the lion gate. One by one, much nearer now, the strange stars appeared again. I stood alone in the battlements, a child in the dark, and said to myself, "Surely not." But yet I knew the truth. Not stars, but torches in the hands of men. Briefly I had seen them. Then they had entered the black forest and disappeared, and now were out of it and fast approaching Amyclae. It is risky to walk at night. Wild beasts, bad footing, and evil spirits. But with hundreds of torches, these men were safe from robbers and wolves. Aeneas, the cousin of Paris, had not spent the night in Gythion, As soon as Menelaus and Cineas had sailed away, Aeneas had gathered the very warriors Cnidus had feared, and the Trojan army was marching upon Amyclae by night. Aeneas' men were the robbers and the wolves. I ran to warn the queen, clattering down stone steps, racing across courtyards, throwing open one door after another to the woman's wing, I sped. I flung myself toward the barred wooden door of her bedroom to beat my fist against it until she came. But the door was open, and in her fragrant, well-lit room, Helen admired herself in a silver mirror. "Oh, queen, they have broken their guest friendship," I cried. "The Trojans come armed with Aeneas as their general. You must protect yourself. Paris is your enemy, not your friend. In your husband's stead, you must call out your soldiers. I have seen what pirates can do. You must..."
"Paris is not my enemy."
"He is, O queen. I know you don't trust me. I beg you to trust me now, for the sake of your children, for your own dear sake. The Trojans have come for Amyclae."
"No," said Helen, angling the mirror and smiling at what she saw. "The Trojans have come for me."